All right, welcome everyone to episode number 8 of Talking Shop Down Under. It's been a whole 2 months worth now, which is quite good. And this week we have Nick Bloomhart with us. Welcome, Nick.
Hi, Richard.
How's things?
Good, actually. Pretty sunny up here in Brisbane.
And
how about for you?
Well, I'm meant to be working and you're on holiday, so, you know.
Yeah. Well, yeah, as I said, there's no rest for the wicked, though. This holiday is not really... Not really being an idle one, that's for sure.
It's all about exercise and healthy outdoors, yep. Right?
It is. It is.
Okay, so that's not our audience. Our audience is the unhealthy indoors and pasty white skin and all that sort of thing.
Living under fluorescent light.
That's
yep.
It. Office tan.
Yeah, we recognize our own kind.
Now, Nick, you recently came back to Australia from Microsoft.
6 months ago now, but yeah.
It's
still recent, yeah, I guess. I spent a bit over a year over there working on the Managed Extensibility Framework in .NET 4, which by now just about everybody listening should have their hands on. It's a piece of the BCL for composition, which is pretty closely related to IOC and and some of the other work that we've been doing around the place, like the AutoFact project that I'm...
So I was just going to mention.
Which you were just going to mention.
But I don't need to anymore.
No, well, and AutoFact is an IOC container for .NET. It's probably about 3 years old now, or a bit older than that. We're just coming up to version 2, so some exciting times there. So it's actually at the release candidate stage at the moment, and probably by the time you'll be hearing this this podcast, it should be... the official released version. So the version 2 has actually been about 2 years in the making. Really, AutoFact 1 grew organically, and I guess the strengths of what that was and what people liked weren't really all that known in advance. So as we went through the journey with the AutoFact community and lots of other projects, what was good about AutoFact actually started to become a bit clearer. So the main ideas in AutoFact 2 were just around sort of drawing on the strengths of the ideas in 1, but and making them a bit more central to the design and a bit more transparent to the user.
So I suppose the question that comes to mind originally, like there's in terms of IOC containers, there's actually quite a few floating around at the moment. Castle Windsor Instruction Map and all those things that people immediately bring to mind, or generally, and Unity as well for those who like to follow patterns and practices. How does AutoFact stand out or differentiate from them, or why did you write it in the first place when there were plenty of others around?
I guess the reason I think that there are such a lot of IOC containers around is that once you really try and take full advantage of an IOC container, it becomes such a critical central piece of your app. And even though you may not be, programming directly against its API every day, every major piece of your application is getting constructed and composed with it. So I think there's a lot of there's a lot of different approaches to that problem, and it's really been a real learning process for the whole .NET community as we've gone through different iterations, and AutoFact sort of came along in the middle there when only Windsor and Structure Map were perhaps in really widespread use, and Ninject, I think, was fairly new at the time. Mm-hmm. So AutoFact popped in with the idea that instead of using a lot of configuration like the XML that was then in vogue, and also instead of using a lot of interfaces and service sort of based APIs to configure and extend the container, AutoFact came along just as C# 3 had been released. So the ideas were to take advantage of Link and Lambda expressions wherever possible to really cut down the surface area that you had to use in order to get your own particular object model created by the container. So I think today AutoFact is still probably one of the most API light containers, in that most of the extensibility points that other containers offer can be achieved with a Lambda expression or some kind of event handler in AutoFact, and that still makes it a really nice container to start to start working with. But as it's evolved, I think the sort of central ideas of Autofac are around really pushing that abstraction as far as it can go. So typically, an application that uses an IOC container steps in and out of the IOC abstraction a lot. You've got a large number of components which are plain old CLR objects, and they're able to get their dependencies injected. But then there's still a fairly large amount of infrastructure code where that container abstraction is shown from the outside, and you see a lot of manipulation of the container APIs. And occasionally, if you want to actually create components on the fly, you have to actually use the container as a client rather than as a managed component in the container. So Autofac really pushes towards making everything in an application a component and getting rid of as much infrastructure as possible. So where other containers tend to, you know, use AOP or prevalently AOP, but other kinds of approaches to get more out of that component model, Autofac tries to actually make components able to declare what they want to do up front without actually having to go and do any extra configuration. So that's probably a bit of a weighty sort of statement to just try and just try and get across in 10 words. But the Autofac 2 feature set's really heavily based on automatically providing things like a func if you want to create a component on the fly. Instead of actually using container.resolvex, your component can take a dependency on func of x, and then that will just get injected by the container automatically like anything else. And when you invoke the function, you'll get an instance of x back with all of its dependencies, and you don't ever really see the container in your actual application code when you're using Autofac. And that idea is popped up a few different places in the .NET IOC world, like Meth, sorry, obviously.
Just need to interrupt. I think the crows in the background are getting quite vocal at the moment.
Yeah, they are. All right, need a few stones to throw. No, so that idea's been around for a while, as far as getting all of the instances of a particular service has been supported by a few containers through IEnumerable or through arrays.
Yep.
For quite a long time. So a component that needs all of the instances of T can just have an IEnumerable of T dependency, and the container understands that relationship type and actually doesn't go and look for a component that exposes IEnumerable of T, but reads that as needing all of the other components, and the IEnumerable part is just like a little piece of communication to the container. And then obviously Meth actually provides lazy of T and uses that quite extensively in .NET 4 to declare that a component's not going to be used, at the point that, or that a dependency isn't going to be used at the point that a component's instantiated. So if a Meth component wants T, but wants T at some point in the future, that sounds like a cup of tea, doesn't it? yes. If a Meth component actually wants to get created in the morning and then have its tea at night, it can take a dependency on lazy of tea. And again, the container doesn't go and look for a component that exposes lazy of tea. It actually understands that tea is the service that the component needs, and then adds that bit of lazy semantics itself. So that covers another case where typically people would go and call the container as a service locator to avoid that upfront initialization that you get with constructor injection.
So just on service locator, I suppose a lot of people still use that as a general pattern for instantiating objects later on in terms of an object's lifetime, just other dependencies. Why is service locator considered a less than ideal pattern generally?
I think that there's a huge amount of really successful software that's built on service locator. For instance, everything built with .NET's component model namespace up until now, typically used the service provider's extensibility in there. The reason that I think we're tending away from service locator is that at large scales where there are a large number of components, using service locator doesn't really give you a good outside picture of how your components relate to each other. For instance, if a component uses a service locator internally to find, you know, an instance of another component, mm-hmm. T, then there's no way that, or you, there's no way that a piece of tooling or any developer who's not actually going to read the source code can tell up front that dependency is there.
Mm-hmm.
And in a sort of a small application where typically you've got one developer who understands the whole code base or a small team that understands the whole code base, you can get away with that because I know that if I want to, say, take a set of components from the web tier and move those back into some back-end service, then I know because I know the code which other pieces of the app I need to move with them. Whereas as teams get bigger and products get bigger, there's not really that information up front available anywhere with a service locator, and people don't generally have all of that info stashed away in their brains. So when you want to make large-scale changes to the app, you don't really get any help from the compiler or any help from any of the other tooling. Whereas with an IOC container, you can actually, with constructor injection, I suppose, yep. Which is the other alternative to, mm-hmm. to service location. Each class actually specifies what it needs, and it makes it a lot easier to sort of explore the code base from the outside or as a third party and really get a good understanding of what the relationships between things are, because those dependencies aren't tucked away under the covers. It's almost like object orientation works really well in its sort of encapsulation idea up to a point where, you know, it's quite nice to be able to just create a customer object and call save and have that automatically save to the database, for instance. I mean, conceptually, that kind of idea sounds really good from the perspective of a maintainer or a client programmer. But you know, in reality, we end up in a lot of situations where we really need to change code. And once you start having to change code that you didn't write yourself, then encapsulation works against you to some degree, because it's only through trial and error and, you know, observing runtime behavior and conditions that you can really get an understanding of how all the pieces of an app interact. So, I mean, I might not have understood that when I called save on customer, that was really going to go and send an email, for instance, as well as store something to the database. Whereas, you know, if I have a service instead that actually, or a component that's going to be used as a service that mm-hmm. shows that the database server and the email server are both needed in order to perform an action, I don't need to go and poke around. I've got that info up front. So it's really that the constructor injection / component oriented concept is really about easing off a little bit of that encapsulation to let applications stay more malleable as they grow.
Which is a good thing.
Which is a very good thing. And you know, it takes a little while to get used to, I guess, as far as a switch in thinking, because I think we all really like to have a really clean kind of noise-free interface on things, and you get a lot of feedback from people who are just trying IOC for the first time that they don't like these big constructor lists because they, you know, they provide clutter and all the rest of that. But eventually, over time, you start to realize that that's an asset, that constructor argument list, and it's the most valuable piece of documentation about a class when you're the maintainer, because you really understand how that class fits into the rest of the system.
Well, the other thing, I suppose, that comes to that is if you end up with a constructor that's got 17 different things needing to be injected, then you've probably got a code smell anyway, saying that this is a bit of a god class.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And it doesn't seem to really matter for me how long I go writing software with these techniques. I still end up in that situation every now and then and find, yes, I really do have 23 arguments to this constructor. I have a problem.
What the hell happened? You know,
what happened? And actually, yeah, it raises a red flag as well that you can then, you know, actually show to other members of your team and say, this class has too many dependencies. We need to refactor here. So, you know, that extra piece of communication that you get from that constructor is gold to me. Anyway.
Yeah, I suppose with a service like Kata, you'd never see that because you just have a method that's calling off to, you know.
Yeah, through the body of
locator
that.
Locator.findMeA.
Yeah, exactly. And in those classes where you do have that the red flag of, you know, 17 constructor parameters, if you've got a, you know, even a 300 line class, which isn't really big, perhaps as far as it might be at the top limit of what you really want in an app. But, you know, amongst 300 lines, 17 different service locator calls probably just blend in, you know, to the woodwork, and you don't realize that class is really becoming very dependent on a lot of other classes around it. So,
okay, so moving on to AutoFac 2, with the fact that the release candidate's out and the release to web or whatever we're going to call it.
Yes, RTW, that sounds great.
Is imminently due.
What goodies can we all expect?
What goodies can we expect? What are the exciting things that are in the Easter show bag for us?
That's it. What goodies have we actually been enjoying? We've had some good times exploring AutoFac 2 on the team that I'm working with at the moment, and yeah, I feel bad that the whole world is missing out. No, actually, no, that probably is taking it too far. But
it's a guilty pleasure, right?
No, I think the big things that you'll notice in AutoFac 2 are probably just the adaptations to where IOC's gone in the last 12 months or 18 months. So. AutoFac in version 1 required that you register every component, whereas in version 2 there's scanning support, and you can use, you know, a really terse lambda driven syntax to choose which components in an assembly will get registered, and the container will actually go and find those. And
so a more convention over configuration approach.
Yeah, more of a convention over configuration approach, but also the way that AutoFac 2 is really taking things with the relationship types that it supports, which is another feature that version 2 has, I'll come back to.
Okay.
It's really just pushing components to a more declarative sort of format. So in AutoFac 1, anything goes as a component. And actually, anything goes as a component in AutoFac 2. You can, you know, you don't really need to think too hard about up front exactly what the shape of a component should be or how it should implement its interfaces. But, you know, AutoFac 2 gives you enough little helpers in declaratively sort of specifying how your component should work that you're incented to make your components a bit more regular.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's definitely improving the code I'm writing at the moment. So scanning is definitely a big improvement over the first version, even though, you know, it's a matter of a couple of lines of reflection code to go and find all of the types in an assembly and register them. It just helps to have a nice declarative syntax for that. The other things that are in there are more MEF inspired, I suppose, and getting in line with what's coming in .NET 4. So if you're on .NET 4, you'll get support for lazy of T just like MEF provides.
Nice.
Which is very nice. There's also support for metadata, which is similar to the MEF feature. And actually, all of the AutoFac 2 features will integrate with MEF if you use the AutoFac 2 MEF integration, which is probably another of the sort of standout features that the version 2 has. So
what you just mark up your components with your exports and imports, and then push it into the container or into MEF? Well,
I think there's, I suppose to segue on that, there's really a few different levels of extensibility that an application might have. Now, you know, AutoFac is really built for closed web applications. It's a bit exclusionary to you know, target that part of the, you know, the app development world so much, but the way that AutoFac is constructed, it attempts to bring as much forward to the creation of a container as possible, so that once a container is up and running, everything's, you know, light, fast, pre-calculated, cheap. So AutoFac itself in its core is a really kind of closed system. It's not really designed for loading anything on the fly or for loading third-party components, for instance. And most applications are probably a little bit, like, well, a lot lighter on extensibility than what you would expect to need something like Meph for. So there's an integration in AutoFact 2.
But Meph at the same time is not just about extensibility. It's about the way you architect an application, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Meph has a whole other take on a lot of approaches to architecture than we're typically using with AutoFac and the other containers of today. And I think that will really catch on as well, because Meph brings some really interesting and novel techniques to the table there. But as it becomes more established, I think one thing we'll see is that APIs for extensibility in .NET, so plugins for whatever kinds of applications and platforms, will use the Meph markup
mm-hmm.
to express what they're exposing and provide metadata and all the rest of that. So I suppose the second sort of level of extensibility is somewhere in the middle there, where an app's pretty much like the typical applications we're building today, but has a couple of extension points. So say for different pieces of business logic, or for some more trivial kinds of plugins,
Different rules that you might be applying or something like that.
Yeah, very, very much flat extensibility points. So you might have one kind of extension that the app supports, or two kinds of extension that the app supports, and that's adequate for a lot of business sort of scenarios where you're not building an actual product so much as building a bespoke system. Mm-hmm. So the AutoFact Meph integration gives you that ability. You can actually have third parties specify their extensions using the Meph model, but then consume them using the AutoFact container transparently. So in order to write a plugin for an AutoFact 2 driven app,
mm-hmm.
you can actually write the plugin as though you're targeting a Meph driven app, and AutoFact 2 will host the components, and you really won't notice any difference as a plugin writer. Of course, as an app developer, you really only have to think about the extensibility aspect around those few isolated APIs that you want to expose and consume from third parties. Where the next step up from that, which is really Meph's sweet spot, I think, is where the entire app is built to be extensible and composed from third-party pieces. And AutoFact's completely out of that game, in a sense. And as you dig more and more into what's necessary to make that happen robustly, the IOC containers that we're using today really aren't optimized and don't have the feature set that you would end up with if you started with extensibility as your first goal. Mm-hmm. So probably would go some way towards answering the question, why Meph, when there's already IOC containers, for instance. But
since we're talking about AutoFact,
we should probably head back to AutoFact land. But as far as AutoFact 2 fitting into .NET 4, I think that's one central thing. There's a lot of new goodness in .NET 4 for IOC containers, and there's more coming. And a lot of that's due to Meph being in .NET 4 and having some very similar paradigms that drive it. So I think we should all, in IOC in a few years, or maybe even less, be using those sorts of little additions. So I suppose some of the work in the AutoFact 2 stream's just been to be a better citizen of .NET 4 and let people continue to use the standard sort of .NET 4 paradigms for things where they've been established now.
Okay.
But some of the other things that come along with .NET 4 that AutoFact supports other than lazy revolve around metadata, I think I mentioned before as well. I think it's something that's really, really, really cool, and it's going to be really widely used, I hope. Let's say we're writing a task scheduler, and we're going to have a sort of a central scheduling engine, and it's going to have a dependency on all of the different kinds of tasks that are plugged in. So I might have a task for sending emails every 30 minutes, and I might have another task that's going to go and check some back-end process to make sure that it hasn't died, and that happens at 12 o'clock every night.
Yep.
So using a pure IOC kind of approach to things, the task scheduler, when it starts up, wants to get access to those tasks. So you can imagine it taking a dependency on IEnumerable of task.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't necessarily want instances of those tasks. It wants to know about the kinds of tasks so that, you know, if and when they need to be executed, they can then be created. And metadata is all about providing that extra information about the component to the consumer before it's used. So we might have a piece of metadata called due at on each task. And so in your AutoFact configuration or even as a MEF export, but not to get too tied up in the details, you might specify that the value for that component for due at is 12 o'clock a.m.
Yep.
And then when the task scheduler takes a dependency on that list of tasks, it actually takes a dependency on another type, say meta of T or lazy of T metadata, that allows it to consume that information about the task before it actually works directly with an instance. So it gives you some configuration. It gives you some configuration info that's independent of the container. So you can still actually test your task scheduler, passing it in the appropriate metadata and making sure it does its things. But all of that information that's going in is actually, you know, provided through container configuration.
So instead of picking up properties of your various tasks to read information about them, you've got those.
Yeah,
that
exactly.
Information is something else so that you can instantiate them separately and manage the lifetime of them separately.
Yeah, and probably a line of code here would speak 1,000 words, I think. It's actually a very simple concept. It's just that it's another one of the little tools that come with AutoFact 2 and soon probably many other containers, I hope, that let you work as if you're completely in the container abstraction. So even though you know that these tasks are getting plugged in by an IOC container,
yep.
you don't really have to step out and look at some kind of configuration API to find out about task configuration. And you also don't have to go and create a task factory object for every task that holds that information.
So the information itself, do you put that in attributes on the task itself, or are you putting it in a completely separate class?
The MEF way is that you would put attributes on the task itself.
Yep.
With AutoFact, you are free to add the information however you like. So some of the examples I've worked with are perhaps when you're scanning, say, and you're going to add the name of a command, for instance, as a piece of metadata, you would actually set up a rule when you're scanning to say, you know, find all the types in this assembly that implement I command. And then take this part of their name, the type name before command. So instead of save command, you'll pull out the save, and then associate that with the command name metadata key. And so you can really, there's an infinite number of ways you can figure out that metadata. But the most common way in AutoFact is just to actually specify it in an XML config file or in your programmatic configuration somehow.
Because the task scheduler, you're really going to want to vary around what those things are.
Yeah, which is a funny sort of return, I think, as well. AutoFact started out as a zero XML sort of concept.
Where here it is again.
It was a bit of a rebellion, in a sense, from all of the, you know, really heavy XML configuration we had. But
conceptually, the reason's quite different, right? Because XML is originally because we would change implementations, but we're not really talking about changing implementations. We're talking about changing configuration, which is a config file XML's situation. Kind of, that's what XML's for.
Absolutely. You don't by any means need to register every component that way, but if you've got that configuration that you want to vary, you know, through deployment somewhere, and then app.config is still a great place to put it. So
what else is new in Auto 2?
Aha. We've got some better syntax for the registration of components that lets you use covariance if you're on .NET 4, which is a little bit nicer. And some of the little Lambda expressions that you can plug in in lieu of other, you know, more advanced container APIs. Mm-hmm. Use strongly typed parameters now, other than what was in AutoFAC 1, which is generally, you know, if I want to get a callback every time an object's created, in AutoFAC 2, you have a, you know, a callback that's on type T, which is the type of the component, rather than the other way around. So, or rather than object, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
But so that's nice. And there's a few more things in there to pretty things up. And also, a bit of a departure from the way that AutoFAC 1 was put together is that AutoFAC 2 really brings forward a lot of configuration to the time that you're actually building up the container. So AutoFAC alone, in being the only container that has a separation between the API for configuration and the API for consuming components. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but in AutoFAC, you'll create a container builder, and through the container builder, you'll add all of your component registrations, which mm-hmm. are really the directive saying that for type X, I want to use component Y.
Yep.
And then after you've done all of your configuration, you call build, and that gives you a container that you can then go and work with. And that concept's been around since the first versions of AutoFAC. Mostly, I think, in the early versions, because it really simplifies the API to show just what you actually want to need, what you want to see at each stage of the process. So when you're actually configuring your container, you don't really need to see those methods for runtime querying and that sort of thing, because all you're doing is adding components and telling the container where to find them. But then at runtime, when you're actually thinking about how to get components out, you don't really want to see all of the registration methods. So that's the original sort of impetus. But an interesting kind of side effect in AutoFAC 1 was that I noticed as the further you could split those APIs, the less you had to worry about locks and concurrency and consistency issues in the container. So because it's possible to do all of your configuration up front, yep. you don't have to actually practically globally lock the container every time you want to pull a component out, because there's no chance that at the same time somebody else is going to be, you know, changing the actual components that are going to handle that request. So after humming and hawing a fair bit as AutoFAC 2 came together, the APIs for mutating a container after it's built have really taken a back seat in AutoFAC 2. So in a way, it's a transition, but the AutoFAC 2 design is really pushing towards a two-phase kind of structure for apps, where you'll do all of your configuration up front and then get...
So configure once and then read often.
Configure once and then read often. And in web apps, which is, I think, where AutoFAC is actually getting used,
yep.
that's a very acceptable trade-off to have very, very low contention and you know, a lot better efficiency mm-hmm. because of the, you know, the not having the need to make sure that everything's
redoing everything every time, are you? All right. So if people want to know more about all of this, where do they go?
AutoFAC is at autofac.org.
And that's F-A-C-K or F-A-C?
No, it's F-A-C. A-U-T-O-F-A-C.
Very good.
In case there's any doubt as to the... Yes, as to the spelling as well. It's one word, so there's no capital F in the middle there. it's inspired
by...
It's not camel cased, no. It's not automatic factory, although it's a bit of a pun. But an AutoFAC in one of Philip K. Dick's novels is actually a self-replicating machine, and that was kind of cool at the time I was reading it and made a good name for an IOC container. So, yes, definitely not camel cased. But yes, at autofac.org. My blog is at nblumhardt.com, which is nblumhardt.com. You can find some interesting things there. And if you're interested in any of the meth subjects that have come up in this discussion as well, you can find the meth documentation at mef.codeplex.com. That's the project site there.
Excellent. All right, we'll call it a wrap there. Nick, thanks for that.
Thank you, Richard.
pleasure as always. And for anyone who's interested in what's happening over the next few weeks with the podcast, I'm going to be at the Australian ALM conference doing some podcasting there and with the Easter break and everything else. So the schedule might be a little bit out, but it will be all good from there. So expect a few more things to come out from that. But Nick, thanks again for your time and appreciate it very much. And thank you everyone for listening to Talking Shop Down Under. We'll see you next time.